From the back of the gelding, Zuga had a grandstand view of the charge, and he had no illusions as to the danger of the moment. Even such a tiny war party of Matabili Amadoda on the rampage through the camp could cause chaos and frightful slaughter amongst the unarmed black labourers.
Bazu! Kawulisa! Stop them! He roared,
spurring across the front of the murderous rank of rawhide shields and steel. The erstwhile tormentors ran with their heads twisted backwards, yelling with terror and eyes popping. They knocked each other down, and the fallen grovelled in the dust. A portly black man, dressed in grubby duck breeches many sizes too small and a frock coat many sizes too large, ran into the side of one of the shacks lining the track, the home of one of the less affluent diggers, and the canvas wall burst open before the power of his run. The thatch roof collapsed on top of the fugitive, covering him completely with a haystack of dried grass and probably saving his life. For the point of a Matabili assegai had been inches from the straining seam of his bulging breeches at the moment the shack collapsed. Batso gave a single blast on the buckhorn whistle that hung on a thong at his throat, and the spearsman froze. The charge stopped dead on the instant, and the Matabili trotted back to where they had dropped their baggage, all of them grinning with delight. As they formed up again, Batso sang the first line of the Inyati regiment war chant in a high, ringing voice.
See the war shields black as midnight, white as the high storm clouds at noon.
And the men behind him came crashing in with the chorus.
Black as the Inyati bull, white as the egrets that he carries upon his back.
The entry of the little band of warriors to the new rush diggings became a triumphal procession. Riding at their head, Zuga felt like a Roman emperor. Yet not one of the young warriors had ever swung a pick or hefted a shovel. Jan Sharut had to place the tools in their hands, positioning their fingers correctly on the handles, all the while muttering his disdain of such ignorance. However, they had the knack of it within minutes, and the velvety black muscles, forged in war and the training for war, changed the mundane tools into lethal weapons. They attacked the yellow earth as though it were a mortal adversary. Confronted with a wheelbarrow for the first time, two of them lifted it bodily and walked away with it and its contents. When Ralph demonstrated the correct use of the vehicle, their wonder and delight was childlike, and Batso told them smugly, "I promised you many wonders, did I not?" They were a highly disciplined group of young men, accustomed since childhood firstly to the strict structure of family life in the kraals, and then from puberty to the communal training and teamwork of the fighting regiments. They were also fiercely competitive, delighting in any challenge to pit their strength or skill against one another. Zuga, knowing all these things, organized them in four teams of four men, each named after a bird: the cranes, the hawks, the shrikes, and the kohans. And each week, the team with the best performance in lashing the gravel was entitled to wear the feathers of their adopted bird in their hair, and to a double ration of meat and mealy meal and twala, the African beer fermented from millet grain. They turned the work into a game. There were some small adjustments to be made. The Matabili were cattlemen, their whole lives devoted to raising, protecting, and enlarging their herds, even if these expansions were often at the expense of their less warlike neighbours. Their staple diet was beef and maas, the calabash-soured milk of the Nguni. Beef was an expensive item on the diggings, and it was with patent distaste that they sampled the greasy, stringy mutton that Zuga provided. However, hard physical labour builds appetites, and within days they were eating this new diet, if not with relish, at least without complaint. Within those same few days, the labour was apportioned, and each man learned his task. Jan Sharut could not be inveigled down into the workings.
Ekasnia miakatni,
he told Zuga loftily, reverting to the bastard Dutch of Cape Colony.
I'm not a mongoose. I do not live in a hole in the ground.
Zuga needed a trusted man on the sorting tables, and that was where Jan Sharut presided, squatting like a yellow idol over the glittering piles of washed gravel. The triangular shape of his face was emphasized by the scraggy little beard on the point of his chin, by the high oriental cheekbones and slanted eyes, each in their spider web of wrinkles. He was quick to pick out the soapy sheen of the noble stones in the piles of dross. But there was another pair of eyes sharper and quicker. Traditionally, the women made the best sorters, but little Jordan proved immediately to have an uncanny talent at picking out diamonds, no matter what their size or colour. The child picked the very first stone from the very first sieveful. It was a minute stone, 20 points, a fifth part of a carat, and the colour was a dark cognac brown, so that Zuger doubted its integrity. But when he showed it to one of the copy wallopers, it was a veritable diamond, and the buyer offered him 3 shillings for it. After that, nobody questioned Jordan. Instead, a doubtful stone was passed to him for judgment. Within a week, he was the devil's own chief sorter. He sat opposite Jan Cheroot at the low metal table, almost the same size as the Hottentot. He wore a huge sombrero of plaited maize stalks to protect his delicate peach-like skin from the sun, and he sorted the gravel as though it were a game of which he never tired. Competing with Jan Cheroot avidly, a high-pitched shriek of excitement signalled each discovery, and his neat little hands flew over the gravel like those of a pianist over the ivory keyboard. Zuger had found a woman to give both Ralph and Jordan their lessons. The wife of a Lutheran preacher, she was a plump-breasted, sweet-faced woman with iron-grey hair swept up into an enormous bun at the back of her head. Mrs. Gander was the only schoolmistress within 500 miles, and for a few hours each morning she gave a small group of diggers' children their reading, writing and arithmetic in the little galvanised iron church at the back of Market Square. It was a daily ritual to which Ralph had to be driven by his father's threats, and to which Jordan hurried with the same enthusiasm as he did to the sorting table after school was out. With his angelic looks and the intense interest in the written word that a letter had germinated in him, Jordan was instantly Mrs. Gander's darling. She made no effort to conceal her preference. She called him Geordie dear, and gave to him the task of wiping clean the blackboard, which immediately made it an honour for which the dozen other children in the class would have scratched out his lovely, densely lashed angel eyes. There was a pair of twins in Mrs. Gander's class, the tough sons of a tough, out-of-luck digger from the Australian opal fields. They were a matched pair, with shaven heads to inhibit the breeding of lice, barefooted, for their father was working a poor claim on the eastern edge of the diggings, their braces supporting patched canvas breeches over faded and frayed shirts. Henry and Douglas Stewart made a formidable pair, acting in complete concert, quick with a cruel jibe too soft for Mrs. Gander to hear, or a crafty jab with the elbow, or a tug of the hair too quick for her to see. Jordan was natural prey. Geordie girl, they christened him, and his soft curls felt good between their fingers, and his tears were enormously satisfying, especially when they realised that Jordan, for some strange reason of pride, would not appeal to his big brother for protection. "You tell Goosey Gander that I've a bellyache," Ralph instructed Jordan, "and that Papa says I'm too sick to come to class." "Where are you going?" Jordan demanded. "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to the nest. I think the chicks may be ready." Ralph had discovered a Lanner falcon's nest on the top ledge of a rocky koppie 5 miles out on the Cape Road. He was planning to take the chicks and train them as hunting falcons. Ralph always had exciting plans. It was one of the many reasons why Jordan adored him.
"Oh, let me come with you, please, Ralph."
"Oh, you're still a baby, Geordie."
"I'm nearly 11.
"You're only just 10, Ralph corrected him loftily, and from experience Jordan knew there was no profit in arguing. Jordan delivered Ralph's lie for him in such sweet, piping tones and with such a guileless flutter of the long lashes that it never occurred to Mrs. Gander to doubt it, and the Stewart twins exchanged a quick glance of complete accord. There was a latrine at the back of the church, a sentry box of corrugated iron, a boxwood seat with an oval cut from it suspended over a galvanised steel bucket. The heat in the tiny room was oven-like, and the contents of the bucket ripened swiftly. The twins trapped Jordan there in the mid-morning break. They had hold of an ankle each and were standing on the wooden seat, the hole between them, and Jordan was dangling upside down, clinging desperately to the boxwood seat as they tried to force his head and shoulders through the opening and into the brimming bucket.
"Stamp on his fingers," Douglas panted.
Jordan had offered unexpected opposition. Douglas had a red scratch down his neck, and they had to pry Jordan's jaws open to release their grip on Henry's thumb. The injuries had changed the mood of the twins. They had started out with laughter, spiteful laughter, but laughter all the same. Now they were angry and vicious, their self-esteem smarting as much as their injuries.
"Shut up, you little sissy,"
blurted Henry, as he obeyed his brother and brought down his horny heel on Jordan's white knuckles. Jordan's shrieks of agony and horror and terror reverberated in the tiny iron shed as he kicked and fought. Against their combined strength, Jordan's wildest efforts were ineffectual. His fingernails scratched white splinters from the wooden seat, and his shrieks mounted hysterically. But his head was forced down. The stench was suffocating. The disgust choked his throat and strangled his cries. At the moment that he felt the cold, wet filth soaking into his golden curls, the door of the shed was wrenched open, and Mrs. Gander's motherly bulk filled the opening. For a moment she stared incredulously, and then she began to swell with outrage. Her right arm, muscled from kneading bread and pounding wet washing, flew out in a round, open-handed blow that knocked both twins flying into a corner of the latrine. And she gathered Jordan up, holding him at arm's length. With her flushed face wrinkling at the smell of his soaked curls, she rushed out with him, shouting to her husband to bring a bucket of precious water and a bar of the yellow and blue mottled soap. Half an hour later, Jordan reeked of carbolic soap, and his curls were fluffing out again as the sun dried them into a shining halo. And from behind the closed doors of the vestry, the yells of pain emitted by the twins were punctuated by the clap of the Reverend Gander's Malacca cane walking stick as his wife urged him on to greater endeavour. Around the whittled remains of Colesberg Coppy had grown up a miniature range of man-made hillocks. These were the tailings from the diamond cradles, dumped haphazardly on the open ground beyond the settlement. Some of these artificial hills were already 20 feet high, and they formed a wasteland where no tree nor blade of grass grew. A maze of narrow footpaths laced the area, made by the daily pilgrimage of hundreds of black workers to the pit. The short cut between the Lutheran church and Zuger's camp followed one of these footpaths, and in the heat-hushed hour of noon, the labourers were still in the workings and the hills were deserted. The sun directly overhead threw only narrow black strips of shade below the mounds of loose gravel as Jordan hurried along the dusty path, his eyes still red-rimmed with weeping the tears of humiliation and stinging from the foam of carbolic soap.
"Hello, Geordie girl."
Jordan recognised the voice instantly, and it stopped him dead, blinking his swimming eyes in the sunlight, peering up at the summit of one of the gravel mounds beside the path. One of the twins stood silhouetted against the pale blue noon sky, his thumbs hooked into his braces, his shaven head thrust forward, his eyes with their thin colourless lashes as vicious as those of a ferret.
"You told, Geordie girl," the twin accused flatly.
"I never told,"
Jordan denied, his voice squeaking uncertainly.
"You screamed, that's the same as telling. And now you're going to scream again, but this time there isn't going to be anyone to hear you, Geordie girl."
Jordan spun around, and in the same movement, he was running with all the desperation and speed of a gazelle pursued by a hunting cheetah. But he had not gone a dozen frantic paces when the second twin slid down the sloping bank, the gravel hissing around his bare feet, full into the narrow pathway ahead of Jordan. His arms spread in welcome, his mouth twisted into a grin of anticipation. They had laid the trap with care. They had caught him in a narrow place, where the gravel banks were highest, and behind him the first twin slid adroitly down to block the path, keeping his balance on the little avalanche of rolling gravel under his bare feet until he hit the level pathway.
"Geordie dear," called one twin. "Geordie girl,"
echoed the other, and they closed from each side, slowly, tantalising themselves, so that Henry giggled almost breathlessly.
"Little girls shouldn't tell tales."
"I'm not a girl,"
whispered Jordan, backing away from him.
"Then you shouldn't have curls."
"Only girls have curls."
Douglas groped in his pocket, and brought out a bone-handled clasp knife. He opened the blade with his teeth.
"We're going to turn you into a boy, Geordie girl. Then we're going to teach you not to tell tales."
Henry brought out his hand from behind his back. He had cut a camel thorn branch and stripped the bunches of lacy leaves, but not the thorns.
"We're going to do the same to you as old Goosey Gander did to us. 15 cuts each. That's 30 for you, Geordie girl."
Jordan's gaze fastened on the branch with sickened fascination. It was twice as thick as a man's thumb, more a club than a cane, and the thorns were half an inch long, each on a little raised knob of rough black bark. Henry swung it in an experimental cut, and it hissed like an adder. The sound galvanized Jordan. He whirled and flew at the high bank of gravel beside him. It slid treacherously under his feet, so that he had to use his hands to claw his way towards the summit. Behind him, the twins yipped with excitement, like the hunting call of a pack of wild dogs, and they raced after him, scrambling up the soft, collapsing bank. Their weight buried them at each pace above the ankles, so that Jordan, lighter and buoyant with terror, reached the top of the bank ahead of them, and he raced, silent and white-faced, across the flattened table of the summit, opening the gap further. Henry snatched up a stone as he ran, a lump of quartz as big as his own fist, and he used his own momentum to hurl it. It flew an inch past Jordan's ear, and he flinched and whimpered, losing his balance, stumbling at the far edge of the dump, and went stumbling down the steep slope.
"Stop him!"
yipped Douglas, and launched himself over the edge. At the bottom, Jordan rolled to his feet, dusty and wildly dishevelled, his curls brushed out and dangling in his eyes. He wasted a second, glancing about desperately, and then darted away along the narrow footpath through the gut of the pass between the gravel dumps.
"Catch him! Don't let him get away!"
the twins yelled at each other, panting with laughter, like two cats with a mouse. And here on the flat, their longer legs quickly narrowed Jordan's lead. He heard their bare feet slapping on hard earth in a broken rhythm close behind him, and he twisted his head back over his shoulder, almost blinded with his own sweat and dancing curls, his breath sobbing, his skin white as bone china, and his huge, brimming eyes seemed to fill his whole face. Henry steadied himself, poised with his right arm held back at full stretch, and then he threw the thorn stick, cartwheeling it low over the ground so that it slammed into the back of Jordan's knees, the thorns ripping the soft, bare skin, raising deep, parallel scratches, as though from the slash of a cat's claws. Jordan's legs folded under him and he went down, sliding on his belly, the wind driven from his lungs as he hit the baked earth of the pathway. Before he could raise himself, Douglas landed with all his weight between Jordan's shoulder blades and shoved his face cheek down against the ground, while Henry snatched up the thorn branch and danced about them, looking for an opening, the branch held in both hands above his head.
"His hair first,"
gasped Douglas, choking with laughter and his own excitement. "Hold his head." Henry dropped the cane and stooped over Jordan, grabbing a double handful of the fine curls and leaning back against it with all his weight so that Jordan's neck was stretched out. Douglas was still perched between Jordan's shoulder blades, pinning him against the earth and brandishing the open clasp knife. He told his twin,
"Hold him still."
The fine golden hair was stretched like the strings of a violin, and Douglas hacked at it. It came away in tufts at Henry's fists, some of it cut through, some of it torn out at the roots, like feathers from the carcass of a slaughtered chicken, and he threw it high in the air, shouting with laughter as it sparkled in the sunlight.
"Now you'll be a boy!"
All the resistance went out of Jordan. He lay crushed against the earth, shaken only by his own sobs, and Henry grabbed another handful of his curls.
"Cut closer,"
he ordered his twin, and then shrieked with shock and pain. The thin, tapered end of a rhinoceros hide riding whip curled with a snap around the seat of Henry's breeches, over the fresh bruises raised by the Reverend Gander's Malacca cane, and Henry shot erect, clutching at his own buttocks with both hands and hopping up and down on the same spot. A hand closed on the collar of his shirt, and he was yanked into the air and held suspended, kicking a foot above the ground, still clutching the seat of his breeches, that felt as though they were filled with live coals. His brother looked up from his seat on Jordan's back. In the excitement of tormenting the smaller boy, neither of the twins had heard or seen the horseman. He had walked his horse around the bend in the footpath between the gravel heaps and come across the squirming, yelling knot of small bodies in the middle of the path. He recognized the twins immediately. They had earned quick notoriety on the diggings, and it had taken only another second to guess the cause of the commotion, to understand who were the attackers and who the victims.